Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And now, here is your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, videos, thinly veiled advertisements for people that pay me money. Oh, other stuff at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me, absolutely nobody, because Jack sucks and he's not here. He's at Dragon Con or something like that. And we're time traveling again, or at least I am. So, got a really, really busy schedule upcoming. So we're recording a couple of shows, have an awesome interview lined up, two-part interview actually lined up with John Hearn, who some of you may remember. He's been on the show before to talk about the 1986 FBI gunfight. Also, the Newhall massacre or incident or whatever you want to call it. Before we get to John, though, this segment brought to you by Tactical Night Vision Company. The night is dark and full of terrors, or at least it used to be. But now we have the technology to fight the night. And TNVC is your one-stop shop for all your dark fighting needs. From the TNV PVS-14 night vision goggle to the IR Patrol thermal monocular and everything in between, TNVC can outfit your defense against the dark arts. Doesn't matter if it's your lost keys, the enemy, or that little kid from down the street that likes to go out and chase Pokemon in the dark. TNVC has what you need to find things at night. TNVC now with financing. Own or finance the night. So, joining us, John Hearn. John, how's it going, man?
I'm doing great this morning. How about you, John?
Oh, not too bad. I'm living the dream. I cannot complain. So, for those that are not familiar with you or haven't heard your past appearances or sat in on one of your amazing lectures, can you say who you are, what you do, and we'll hop right in?
Yeah, again, my name is John Hearn. Background-wise, I've been a law enforcement officer since 1992. Teach some for my agency, firearms, use of force, and our basic tactics program. I've also been a staff instructor with Tom Givens at Rangemaster since 2001. Since about 2005, I have been researching and presenting around the country, national, international conferences, that sort of thing, on a variety of topics that tie into the gun and the training world, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
And I guess most recently, I spent the last 4 or 5 years doing a ton of research on human performance under stress, and I have about an eight-hour talk I do on that nowadays.
Nice. Now, you forgot one of your greatest accomplishments, I think, or at least one of your most recent greatest accomplishments. You came in fourth place at the last year's Rangemaster Tech Conference match, right?
I did come in fourth. I managed to snag High Lawman, but unfortunately, Spencer Keepers beat me, and I really don't care where I place except that I beat Spencer, so that was a disappointment.
Oh, okay. Well, wait, didn't someone else beat you too? I think there were two more people that also beat you, John.
Well, you know, if you want to go down this road, John, I can point out that one of us has the fastest fast time of record, but that would be just cruel.
I guess. Well, hey, had I not dropped that one headshot, I'd have beat you there too. But you know, whatever. And in fairness, if we're talking about Rangemaster in the TAC conference match, Kirk Clark destroyed all of us by a lot. So there is that.
Yeah, I kind of still demand a test to make sure he's actually human and not a cyborg. I remain skeptical.
Well, so it's actually kind of sad, and I was planning on going to TAC conference this coming year anyway, but after all that happened, I'm like, well, now I have to go because I have to beat Kirk. So it's funny what motivates us. But so anyway, let's get to the topic of the show other than me beating you, because I was one of the other people that beat John. See what you're like, I'm going to hang up now. So you're talking about human performance under stress. There's a lot of a lot of conversation that goes back and forth about this very topic. What are the main parts? You've got it broken down into four general things that we can control that sort of determine who wins, who loses, and why. Or I mean, do you want to expand on that? I'm doing a bad job of leading into this. I apologize.
Well, I got a lot of harassment from Craig Douglas trying to avoid some FCC fines for you.
Thank you.
But he said it was ridiculous that I didn't.
Since we're recording the show, if you curse, I mean, I can just have Joe replace whatever curse word with a funny noise. Yeah, Joe would prefer not to, only because then it costs me like $10 per curse word for him to take the time to do that. But if you want to like PayPal me some money, we can get this thing going, you know?
Yeah, I'll try to keep my funds to myself.
Okay.
But Craig had basically said it's ridiculous that you need 8 hours to present this. You need to reduce this. So I guess I went to the extreme and I reduced it down to one slide. So you can kind of think of like a seesaw, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
On the right side of the seesaw, you have the stuff that you can mostly control. This is stuff that's largely within your realm, not always, but mostly.
Yeah.
And they're prioritized. Number one, your level of emotional control. Number two, the level of learning or automaticity that you have in your skills. As a very distant third is the topic of your overall level of fitness, much more important for law enforcement and military. And finally, just because we have to mention it, is this tiny contribution that's accumulated or attributed to gear.
Yeah.
And again, that's stuff that you can mostly control, and we can kind of break those topics down. Now, what nobody really talks about much in the training world is what's on the other side of the seesaw. And that is that particular scenario, or as the psychologists refer to it, the task complexity that you're facing. And that's what nobody seems to take into account when they try to explain performance, why some can do it and some can't, is a lot of it just kind of has to do with the scenario that you're faced. It's a fundamentally different task to engage an armed robber that approaches you and gives you a few seconds of warning on a parking lot than it is to, say, be a police officer responding to an active shooter event on the scale of Mumbai. You know, that's a completely different event, and a much higher level of preparation would be needed to be able to perform well in that environment.
Well, let me ask you this, since you've brought up like two different examples. You've got like the simple assault in a parking lot, the parking lot robbery, and then you've got the responding to an active shooter or terrorist event. Is when you say task complexity, is it so much that the task is complex, or is it that there are multiple aspects that you need to respond with in tasks like that? Or is it both?
I think it's a bit of both, in that task complexity is actually it's a term from the psychological literature. There is actually a task complexity scale. I believe it ranges from, like, say, 0 to 54. It's got different metrics as far as the number of decisions made on motor skills. So on a purely academic level, that's what we're referring to. Now, overall, we would just call that the scenario. And obviously, we have to assimilate the officer in the active shooter scenario, have to assimilate a much larger amount of information. His assessments for shoots, no shoots, are going to be much more complex given the amount of chaos going on.
Right.
So it's a bit of both.
Whereas for the armed robber in the parking lot, the decision simply boils down to, should I shoot the guy in the face now or in a second?
Yeah, and absolutely. And it's also the dynamics are different in that, you know, a lot of times a police officer will start a contact, but the bad guy starts the fight. And whoever initiates violence always has a huge advantage. On the parking lot, when the armed robber approaches you, he may initiate the contact, but you're the one starting the fight.
Right.
And there's a whole bunch of information out there that says that the guy on the offense is always going to have a huge advantage psychologically, physiologically, because he's carrying out his plan.
Right.
And that's always a huge advantage.
We got about a minute and a half left before we have to go to break. But so I guess we'll go first. Can you give me like a tidbit about just a small snippet? Why is the level of emotional control your number one?
Because everything flows from emotional control. One way to look at my kind of assessment here is I've kind of just rewritten some of Jeff Cooper's principles, the triad there.
Yeah.
But everything flows from that level of emotional control, that combat mindset, the ability to implement the skills that you've developed, all of that comes to that emotional, from that level of emotional control, and it keeps you from getting into that area of fight, flight, freeze, or posture where so many of us have problems.
Okay, perfect. We're talking with John Hearn right now. We're going to get back to him in just a second. You're listening to Ballistic Radio! Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Dana LaFence, the country's leading manufacturer of air rifles and accessories. Dana LaFence, lighter, stronger, better! This segment brought to you by Sig Sauer, now with more options. We're not all the same, and our carry gun shouldn't have to be either. Sig Sauer gives you choices, and with more models than the Bible's got Psalms, it's never been easier to find a Sig Sauer that fits your needs. From the extremely versatile striker-fired P320 with modular grip frame, to the Legion Series P226, the single-stack P225A1, or the entry-level SP2022. Sig Sauer makes a model that's right for you. Just don't ask for Callahan full-bore auto-lock. They don't make that yet. Sig Sauer, when it counts. So we're talking with John Hearn about who wins, who loses, and why, which is actually the title of the slide from his presentation that I'm staring at right now. Before the break, John, we were talking about the why you ranked emotional control as number one. And it's actually timely that I have you on because I've been talking about emotional control on the show for the last month or so with various different people. And you've probably done the most amount of research as anyone I've known on this very topic. So going back to what you were saying before the break, if we don't have emotional control, what do we tend to default to? Or what happens or... Where do people go to mentally, I guess?
Well, you know, you have to remember you kind of have two brains running around inside of your head. You have the emotional, the more primitive brain that is very limited in its responses. It can really only do the fight, flight, freeze, or posture. And its fight is not what we're thinking about. It's a much more primitive fight. So it might be, you know, a gouge, rip, you know, tear, bite, kick sort of a thing.
Right.
Where we are as human beings and where our strengths are lies in that rational mind. Okay, that's the tool user part of our brain, and that's really all guns are, or any other self-defense tool. They're emergency life-saving equipment, but
right.
They're tools, and we have to be in the tool user state of mind to actually be able to do anything effective with them. And what happens is when people, you know, slip and they lose that emotional control, they basically lose all the advantages that evolution, you know, the last, we can call it, what, 2.5 million years of evolution has given us, and we're really, you know, nothing but a naked ape with poor muscular development.
Is there any time when that's useful for us?
There are certainly times when it's useful because the reason it's still there is it is a time-tested survival response. So, for instance, if you're in a world where you have large predators that hunt based on motion, freezing may be a very good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, in theory, you could be in an active shooter event, and maybe you freeze in place and hide, and the bad guy misses you. So there are times and places for that response. It's just that to use the skills that we've been developing, the tools that we've been developing, you really, really have to be more in that rational mind, and possibly, if things are really well, if you really ingrain those skills hard, a lot of times the brain can access stuff that's been stored in implicit memory when it's under high levels of stress. So we're trying to stay rational and use the tools because that's what's going to give us our huge advantage in a fight.
All right. That makes sense. So after emotional control, what else do we have that you have made this 1 through 4 scale in order of importance? Tied for number two is kind of the same size as number one. What are we looking at?
Well, and the other thing I'd point out is on the diagram is that there's a lot of overlap between these tools.
It is very Venny that way.
Yeah. What is a Venn diagram? But the point is that if you have a high level of skill, that actually tends to grant you more emotional control. And if you have more emotional control, you tend to be more able to access the skill. So there's a very much a tie there. But the second block is a level of learning or this term automaticity that you have in the particular set of skills you're using. And there's all different ways that this has been conceptualized over the years, you know, the conscious confidence, the unconscious confidence, that sort of a thing.
Right.
But if we practice enough, if we can actually get our skills into is actually a physically separate part of the brain. It's, you know, implicit memory. You can call it procedural memory. They're effectively, you know, procedural memory. It's just a subset of implicit memory. If we can get those skills there, we can tend to access them under stress. So the repetition and emotion associated with those skills are really about the only way to get there. So, you know, automaticity is basically a way of responding without thinking. You know, do I actually have to think about proper trigger control? Do I have to think my gun out of the holster, or does it automatically appear in my hand when I need it?
Right.
It's that level of skill that is going to really help you, because what you're essentially doing is, if you have a very high level of skill, you're not taxing any of our finite mental resources, so it allows the brain to focus more on solving the problem than trying to figure out how to run the weapon.
Now, so let's talk about that for a second. Is there only a certain amount of, you know, for lack of a better term, processor speed that we have, and we've got like a limited amount of mental resources, and you know, some of it's tied up in, I guess, seeing what's in front of us or understanding what's in front of us, and part of it's tied up in other things too, like tool use or whatever.
Yes and no. I hate to be wishy-washy there, because there's a little wiggle room in there.
Okay.
But most people's attentional resources, how much attention they can pay, it's a lot less than what they think they are. And as they start to get adrenalized and they start to deal with some of the coping mechanisms our bodies have, that tends to take a toll on the resources that you have. So our resources are very, very finite. Now, with that said, there are some exceptions in that it's not necessarily popular, but for instance, IQ, or your intelligence, for lack of a better word, is kind of a functional stand-in for, you know, what kind of processor you have up there. And there is some research out there, for instance, in this idea of Hick's Law, which deals with the number of choices we have. People who are, you know, have more raw intelligence actually suffer less from the effects of Hick's Law. So, you know, being smarter, having that faster processor, is never really going to hurt you unless you're doing the analysis paralysis.
Right. And I don't think I've ever heard that before, which is interesting. Why? So is there anything that people can do? And we'll keep on to the larger overall topic here in a second, but is there anything that people can do to, I guess, increase their ability to process information, or make it simpler for them to process information?
Well, I hate to use a lot of computer terms, but if you think about it, what you're talking about are a bunch of subroutines. And I'll take the most obvious one, which is I need to make a shoot or a no shoot decision.
Okay.
Right? And the more you practice that, the better your brain becomes at it. Okay. And eventually you are able to do it faster. And that's a really good example of, Paul Howe has a great algorithm for how to determine whether somebody's a threat or not. And his advice is, you don't practice this on the range, you practice it in Walmart. You walk around in Walmart, you run the algorithm on everybody you meet, and eventually your brain does that automatically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as soon as that becomes automatic, you suddenly have a lot more resources to start worrying about other factors, whether it's cover, friendlies in the background, possibilities of de-escalation. But it's only with a fair bit of work, that horrible four-letter word, that becomes an option for us.
So how much of that, I guess, is people, and I know something that you talk about in your 8-hour presentation is stimuli, and specifically novel stimuli, and how that affects things. What can you talk about that for a second, and sort of tell people what that is and how it can slow us down or not slow us down?
Yeah, what happens is, you know, whenever your brain receives sensory input, it has to make the snap decision as to whether it is bad or not. And the more worse that your brain thinks it is, the more likely it is to rely on the emotional side of the mind. And that would therefore cause us to lose our tool use and our ability to think and process in a way that we would prefer to.
Can you give us an example of what something like that would be, just real quick?
An example of something not, well, I guess a classic example with that would be is, like, for instance, the guy that has only shot paper plates and bullseye targets his entire life, and one day he's confronted with a living, breathing human adversary on the parking lot. There's something to be said for having seen your sights on a human being. So something as simple as using a photorealistic target could mitigate the novelty of having seen your, you know, seeing your sights on a living human, breathing, you know, human being right. for the first time.
Okay. And I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to give people a parking spot for what that might look like. We got about a minute left in this segment, so I'm going to interrupt you again, but please continue.
Well, and I would just point out, since we only have a minute, you know, last time I talked to you, we identified four huge training priorities. And of all the training priorities we can possibly have, removing novelty is the number one thing we can do to have increase our odds of winning. The situations we face and have to deal with, we really should have confronted them, you know, through a mental rehearsal, training, something like that. Otherwise, it really just becomes a roll of the dice.
So is that just a byproduct of if you don't recognize a situation quickly enough, by the time that you do, you're kind of out of luck? Or more complicated than that?
It's probably a bit more complicated from that. If I understand your question, it's kind of if you think about the growing up on the plains of Africa, you know, if I'm walking down there and I see something, I see a lump, and I freeze in place, and I'm like sitting here thinking, is that a lion or a rock? Well, if I default to it's always a lion, I'm always going to be in better shape. So your brain always has that huge trepidation about stuff it doesn't know and understand.
Right. Well, we got to go to break, so hold that thought. We're talking with John Hearn. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of air rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories at www.wilsoncombat.com. So we're talking with John Hearn about all sorts of interesting, to me at least, and hopefully to you, science related to training and performance under stress and gunfighting and other stuff. And you were, before the break, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, I had you bouncing all over the place, but the last thing we left with was if you're in Africa, out on the plains, walking around, and every time you're confronted by like a strange lump, if you default to the position that that's a lion, you're maybe in a better place than just defaulting to assuming it's a rock?
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody that we had in the human lineage that said, oh, that's probably just a rock, those people did not live long enough to pass on their genes. So that brain has that inherent bias toward assuming anything is a threat. Mm-hmm. And the really big keys to, you know, something being a threat is not ever having seen it before. By default, if we haven't seen it before, it must be bad. That's just kind of how we're, you know, at least most of us are naturally wired.
Okay.
So removing novelty becomes hugely important.
When it seems like that, and this is more of a societal comment, I suppose, but it seems like that we are stepping further and further away from that sort of thinking as a society, which isn't necessarily a good thing. But so, yeah, anyway.
Well, the denial of evil is a very, really, very, really real thing that's yeah. ongoing. It's a societal process, and it doesn't do anybody any favors.
And we could spend a lot of time on that, but and I think what I'm going to do, so I've got you, we're going to have a two-part episode for people listening. And what I kind of want to come back to in the next episode is a little bit more about automaticity and the things related to that and how we tell what that is and maybe a little more in depth as to why it's important. But for this part here, let's skip to the next part. And this seems to be one of the ones where there's quite a bit of argument. As far as in the four things in your Venn diagram as far as why they matter, fitness. Where does that fall in, and why is that smaller than maybe some people would expect, at least in your diagram?
Because first off, it depends on the venue in which you're operating.
Okay.
If you are a law enforcement or military person and you are going to be chasing people, running from cover to cover and stuff like that, the level of fitness that you have becomes hugely important because it tends to mitigate against that shift to the emotional brain. Now, there's, you know, it's very obvious that people defend themselves every day without any formal training while in absolutely horrible shape.
Yeah.
But those are, again, people that aren't having to exert themselves before they actually have to shoot. And they're people facing less complex scenarios.
Right.
I would also point out that the fitness goes back to that great term we coined, I think the last time I was on there, about that holistic approach to gunfighting.
Right.
One of the things you have to understand is I talked earlier about how there's this kind of decision point where your brain has to decide how bad something is. There's a lot of things that factor into that. Obviously, novelty is one of them. But something as simple as your personal current state, for lack of a better word, is going to decide whether you go emotional or you're able to stay rational.
Yep.
Your current state could be how much sleep you've had. And exercise really, really helps mitigate a lot of those state issues. You know, if we want to go into a little bit of detail, there is state anxiety and trait anxiety.
All right.
Trait anxiety is kind of how you're wired naturally. There are just some people who are more anxious. State anxiety is how you are today, how you're feeling.
Yeah.
And if you can reduce your state anxiety, it actually does make it more likely that you'll be able to stay in that rational mind. And one of the best ways to mitigate that and have the better state anxiety is to be in good shape. There's this whole interplay between things. Number one, your heart has to work less, but your mind also has confidence, for instance, that you necessarily have a strong body to execute what needs to be done.
Yeah.
So, again, fitness not important for everybody, but when I look at this from a risk perspective, most people in this country die from heart disease. So
yeah.
Fitness is a great twofer, kind of a win, because it makes you perform better under stress. And also, it really does address the most realistic long-term threat to your longevity.
Well, and that seems to be, you know, one of the, and I don't know who said it first, but you can't shoot a heart attack in the face. I mean, it'd be nice if you could, but you can't. And that certainly is something that not many people want to confront for whatever reason. But and going back to like the level of fitness determining your mental state, or at least affecting your mental state, I can, from my own personal experience, when I took ECQC, I was in the worst shape of my life, and getting on the bottom of the pile with the fist helmet on and all that, completely broke apart just because I didn't have anywhere to go, and it became an emotional response and not a good one.
You didn't have any reserve to tap into, and that's a horrible place to be.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's like, wow, I'm gonna die. And that's exactly what it felt like, which was, interesting from a academic standpoint after I got time to process it and wasn't in the middle of it. But, like, in the middle of it was absolutely terrifying, you know. I hear a lot of people, say things like, if we can train people, if we can get their heart rate up and train them at a certain level, then that does X or Y or Z. I mean, is there any truth to that or not so much? What are your thoughts or opinions, or what's the science say about that?
Well, I'm really glad you brought up heart rate, because it's one of the greatest myths that runs around out there. And if I forget to answer your particular question, just remind me, please. But I think one of the best pieces of research that's ever been out there was done by Kathy Vonk. And she had this crazy idea that if we put really high-quality heart rate monitors on law enforcement officers out in the field and in the academy, we can actually understand the stress on human beings.
Right.
And there's always been these diagrams. The Grossman books are filled with them. The Siddle book is filled with them about how when your heart reaches this magical rate, everything falls apart. And that's based on laboratory research.
Yeah.
Well, there's only one slight problem. When Kathy Vonk, ran this experiment for years, gathering all this data, she had people in foot pursuits, vehicle pursuits. I don't know if she had anybody shooting or not, but she was able to gather a huge volume of data. And one of the first things she realized is that this heart rate stuff was complete mythology.
Yeah.
When you actually look at it out in the world, it just doesn't have that automatic effect that everybody thinks it has. What everybody confuses is what's causing it. Everybody thinks that the heart rate goes up, so the brain goes in the tank. And it's actually quite the opposite. All the heart rate tells you is what the brain thinks it needs to solve the problem that it's facing.
Okay.
If the brain thinks it's in a last-ditch, desperate transition to an emotional reaction, then it's going to raise the heart rate and get ready to go for kind of that last-minute all-out fight, nature red and tooth claw kind of a fight. What she found that was really interesting, though, was that people would have elevated heart rates, but they were able to complete tasks. They were able to perform both fine and complex motor skills while doing this.
Right.
The other thing that she did notice, though, was that anybody who had more, you know, the officers that had more fitness suffered less from these effects. And what you would typically see is not a long-term elevated heart rate, but she called it a rev, like just like you blip the throttle on a motorcycle, maybe.
Right.
And that was like the brain going, do we need to do this? Do we need to do this? And I like to think of that as the emotional mind going, no, we still got this. And it was those heart rate blips. If you're in good shape, you tend to have a lot less of those.
Yeah.
And she actually looked at, I think it was a heart rate curve was the term that she used. And again, that level of fitness was hugely significant in how well people could actually perform in the field. So going back to your question.
Yes.
Does elevating your heart rate simulate stress? No, it doesn't, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have value.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, the classic example is suppose you're a police officer and you respond to an active shooter at the mall. Okay. You hit, you know, you grab your patrol rifle, hopefully, you hit the front door and you've got to run toward the sound of the guns.
Yep.
Well, if you've got to run 50 or 100 yards into the mall, your heart rate is still going to be up. So mm-hmm. I think that shooting under that elevated heart rate still has value because you have to learn how to break a precise shot when your lungs are screaming from your air, your heart's pounding. So the people that say that the elevated heart rate simulates stress, I just don't find that to be true, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't have any value.
And that makes sense. And, you know, once again, to tie it back into my own personal experience, which is the only experience that I can tie it back into, so I apologize to everyone that doesn't want me to do this, but, you know, I was recently out of Pacquiao's place, and he's got this beautiful facility that's huge, and, you know, I'll tell you, sprinting 50 or 100 yards and then having to hit a, you know, a 6-inch plate at an unknown distance somewhere between, you know, 50 and 400 yards is a really interesting thing to attempt when your heart rate's up around 140, 150, and you're sucking air like you're dying. You know, but anyway, we got to go to break, John. Hold your thoughts. We'll get right back to them. Right now you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Events, the country's leading manufacturer of air rifles and accessories. Daniel Events, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Surefire. Know your target and what is beyond it. But how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light at it. And that's where Surefire comes in. From the USB rechargeable 300-lumen sidekick, I've got one on my keychain right now, to the 500-lumen X300 Ultra M600 Scout Light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell, Aziz Light, ever again. That's a Fifth Element reference for those of you that missed it. It doesn't matter if you're shining a light at a potential threat or just helping your friends see through their eyelids. When you need all the lumens for longer, you need Surefire. And now is a special offer to Ballistic Radio listeners. If you go to the Surefire.com webpage, you can get 30% off all of their products except for suppressors and batteries by entering the discount code ALLTHELUMENS. That is ALLTHELUMENS. No space. All the lumens at Surefire.com. So anyway, we're talking with John Hearn. And John, I'm sorry I interrupted you at the end of the last segment to tell a story about being fat and trying to shoot. And you were telling us all these things about why people are maybe not, why it's good to elevate heart rate for training, but maybe they're not getting what they think they're getting out of it when they do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I think there's some value to it, but it's not the same thing. I actually had a comment from a friend of mine that listened to the last time I was on the show, and his point was, is like, dude, I've been in competition and I've been in combat, and They're, you know, you talked about it was the same chemical. It isn't. And I'm like, well, no, dude, I beg to differ. It's the same chemicals. It's just how much you're getting over, you know, a given amount of time.
Right.
So, you know, the stress of a match, for instance, might be drinking from a water fountain. Okay.
Yep.
You know, if you have to drink, if you end up getting blasted in the face with a fire hose, it's still water and it's still stress and it still has some use in there.
Darn that dihydrogen monoxide. It's in all the worst
it,
things.
It kills a lot of people.
Yeah, I know, right? Wow, I'm going to start making dihydrogen monoxide jokes, and then people are going to either roll their eyes and change the station or get really mad because they're dumb.
Suddenly Google the dangers of dihydrogen monoxide.
Have you seen the Facebook page that that puts out all the satirical memes about dihydrogen monoxide?
No, I've just seen some of the petitions to get that people are willing to sign to do so.
I'll send you a message on Facebook once we're done recording, and you can your employer can thank me for the wasted hours that I'm about to provide them. So the last thing that's on your Venn diagram, and it's this tiny little dot, and I will include this on the website for people that you know, if you go to the ballisticradio.com webpage when we post this episode, I'll have this in the show description. And by I mean Melody Wills, and she's the one that puts the episodes up. But the last thing on that is gear. And it seems like people want to talk about and focus most on gear, but you've got it as the least important thing. Why is that?
Well, because realistically, if you have the gun on you, that's the range master student experience. If you have the gun with you, you can probably solve the problem. Everybody likes to fixate on the gear because we're affluent Americans and we think we can solve problems with money. And again, they're just really trying to dodge that horrible four-letter word of WORK.
Right.
And there's a lot of marketing that goes into trying to get us to buy this or that. So it's a huge, you know, it's kind of a cultural focus, for lack of a better word, but it really doesn't solve the problem that much for you. Obviously, you have to have a gun to win the gunfight.
Yeah.
But as long as it's a high-quality pistol and, say, at least 9mm caliber, you're probably going to be okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, people get a lot of comfort from having the latest, you know, blaster and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm far more scared of a hard man with a sharp stick.
Yep.
Then I am some internet dweeb that's got the latest gun that doesn't really go out and shoot it. You know,
yeah.
The man with the sharp stick will end up with your gun sooner or later.
Well, and it's, you know, you mentioned at least 9mm caliber, and I'm just like, Claude Werner would win that argument after he shot you in the eye socket with a 22. But yeah, you know what I mean. It just seems like, and I remember having this conversation with him at one point or another with Claude. And I think what I don't know if I said it to him or he said it to me. Probably he said it because it seems a lot more intelligent than something I'd say. But amateurs worry about tools and professionals worry about results, something like that.
Yeah, that sounds like Claude.
Yeah.
But the other thing I'd point out is that the gear you need is related to the scenario that you're facing. For a lot of street-level robberies, you know, shooting the guy a couple times in the face with a 22 will probably work.
Yeah.
And the other thing is Claude is an amazing shot, and he can do that on demand, I have no doubt.
Yeah.
Now, whether you know, the guy that's carrying a cheaply made, you know, Brazilian revolver with a horrible trigger pull that never shoots it.
You can say Taurus. I mean, you can say Taurus on air when you talk about horrible, cheaply.
I'm trying to avoid that.
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
They're never paying me any money, John. It's okay.
The guy with the Taurus revolver in his pocket is never going to solve any problems like Claude can.
Right.
Correspondingly, there are only certain problems, you know, that will certainly be easier to solve. The classic example would be a active shooter style event.
Yeah.
You know, having a full size service pistol is suddenly going to give you a lot more sights and a lot more grip to hold on to make the longer shots that may be needed. I mean, if you can sit there and make a headshot reliably with your 22 at 25 yards and you can hit a full human torso at 50, then, you know, carry on, brother. That's ultimately your decision. But life will generally be easier if you've got something, I don't know, Glock 19-ish of size or better.
Yeah. Well, and it's like,
so you're talking to the guy that carries a 5-inch 45 around most of his life.
Well, and that's, you know, I've posted videos of making headshots with Glock 42 380s. And, yeah, can I do that on camera? And is it kind of like this cool video I can post? But, I mean, it's essentially a parlor trick. Because even though I can do that, I would still much rather have the longer sight radius, the, you know, the better terminal ballistics at that distance with like a 9mm above. And it requires a lot less effort on my part to do something like that. You know what I mean?
So if you've lost a lot of your stress or you've lost skill due to stress, you might have enough skill left to do it with a bigger gun that you might not be able to do with a small gun, huh?
Exactly. And that goes kind of back to the complexity of the task and all that. So let's tie that you know, let's back up and go to the original other side of the scale or seesaw that we were talking about at the beginning of the show. How important do you think it is to prepare ourselves for very complex tasks that might require all of our, you know, skills and abilities, and then be pleasantly surprised if we run into a lesser problem?
That's an interesting question. I think it depends on how you want to live your life.
Okay.
If you're going to be a gambler and you're going to be like, well, I'm good enough and the odds of me hitting something that bad are okay, you know, I'm not going to spend the time, that's your decision.
Right.
But, you know, it comes back to this whole concept of it's not the odds, it's the stakes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, suppose it's your loved one that's, you know, I don't know, 100 yards away that you can't get to and the active shooter is heading towards you.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, that might be the day that you really rue your decision to have your, you know, Taurus 22 revolver and, you know, nothing else.
Yeah.
So it's a personal decision. You know, a great friend of mine says everybody has to work out their own salvation. My own salvation generally begins with a mid-sized pistol in 9mm or greater.
Right. And to be clear, too, we're not – and this is something that a lot of people seem to lose sight of. If I have to pick between you carrying a larger firearm or not carrying a gun at all based off of your own personal circumstances, comfort level, or whatever, I'd much rather you carry a gun rather than no gun. But if you can do more, it doesn't hurt you to do more is essentially what I'm, you know, my position on that. I assume that's probably close to your opinion on that.
And very much so. I think that a lot of it just has to do with people don't know what they can carry effectively.
Right.
You know, when I was younger and stupider, I carried a J-frame off duty because that's all I thought I could reliably conceal.
Right.
Well, I started shooting IDPA, and all of a sudden, there's holsters out there that you allow you to carry a full-size service pistol. And I don't know if you have sponsors that are selling really good holsters right now or not, but there, you know, there are guys out there that do incredible holster work. And it, once you just get used to kind of the weight on your hip, the gun really does disappear, and it's not, you know, that much of an encumbrance to anybody.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, and you know, there's so many good companies that are making really great holsters. I like Darkstar Gear a lot. There's Keeper's Concealment, you know, Raven Concealment. And those are generally the three that I use if I'm going to pick one. But you can do your research and find a good holster. So we're coming up to the end of the show. You're going to hold on because this is going to turn into a two-parter, and we're going to talk about automaticity and all that. So if you want to hold tight, we'll get right back to you, John, for next week, if that's okay.
That sounds great. And I'll just say JM Custom Kydex real quick in your list of good holsters.
Yeah, and you know, and that, and we'll talk about this a little bit next episode, too, or at least the beginning of it. They make great holsters, and for whatever reason, they just never worked for me. But my friend Todd, you know, Todd Green, before he passed away, we talked about it all the time, and he's like, yeah, the ones you like, they don't work for me. Here's the ones I like. It's just funny. It's a very personal decision. But anyway, make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And hey, keep leaving those 5-star reviews on iTunes. We really appreciate it. It helps us out. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next week.